But they've probably forgotten the details of the case and can no longer learn from their successes and mistakes. One field of medicine in which this is definitively not the case is surgery. Unlike mammographers, surgeons tend to get better with time. What makes surgeons different from mammographers, according to Erickson, is that the outcome of most surgeries is usually immediately apparent. The patient either gets better or doesn't, which means that surgeons are constantly receiving feedback on their performance. They're always learning what works and what doesn't, always getting better. This finding leads to a practical application of expertise theory. Erickson suggests that mammographers regularly be asked to evaluate old cases for which the outcome is already known. That way they can get immediate feedback on their performance. Through this kind of immediate feedback, experts discover new ways to perform even better and push our collective OK plateaus ever higher. People have been swimming for as long as people have been getting neck-deep in water. You'd think that as a species, we'd have maxed out how fast we could swim long ago. And yet new swimming records are set every year. Humans keep getting faster and faster. Olympic swimmers from early this century would not even qualify for swim teams at competitive high schools, notes Erickson. Likewise, the gold medal performance at the original Olympic marathon is regularly attained by amateurs just to qualify as a participant in the Boston Marathon. And the same is true not just of athletic pursuits, but in virtually every field. The 13th century philosopher Roger Bacon claimed that nobody can obtain to proficiency in the science of mathematics by the method hitherto known unless he devotes to its study 30 or 40 years. Today, the entire body of mathematics known to Bacon is now acquired by your average high school junior. There's no reason to think that the most talented athletes alive today possess that much more innate talent than the most talented athletes of the past. And there's also no reason to believe that improvements in running shoes or swimwear, while certainly of some significance, could be responsible for the totality of these dramatic improvements. What's changed is the amount and quality of training that athletes must endure to achieve world-class status. The same is true not just of running and swimming, but of javelin throwing, ice skating, and every other athletic pursuit. There's not a single sport in which records don't regularly fall. If there are plateaus out there, collectively, we have not yet reached them. How is it that we continue to surpass ourselves? Part of Erickson's answer is that the barriers we collectively set are as much psychological as innate. Once a benchmark is deemed breakable, it usually doesn't take long before someone breaks it. For a long time, people thought that no one would ever run a mile in under 4 minutes. It was considered an immovable barrier, like the speed of light. When Roger Bannister, a 20-year-old British medical student, finally broke the 4-minute mile in 1954, his accomplishment was splashed across the front pages of newspapers around the world and hailed as one of the greatest athletic achievements of all time. But the barrier turned out to be more like a floodgate. It took only 6 weeks before an Australian named John Landy ran the mile a second and a half faster than Bannister, and within a few years, 4-minute miles were commonplace. Today, all professional middle-distance runners are expected to clock 4-minute miles, and the world record has fallen to 3 minutes and 43.13 seconds. At the World Memory Championship, at least half the existing world records fall each year. Instead of thinking of enhancing my memory as analogous to stretching my height or improving my vision or tweaking some other fundamental attribute of my body, Erickson encouraged me to think of it more like improving a skill, more like learning to play an instrument. We usually think about our memory as a single, monolithic thing. It's not. Memory is more like a collection of independent modules and systems, each relying on its own networks of neurons. Some people have good memories for numbers, but are always forgetting words. Some people remember names, but not to-do lists. SF, Erickson's work-study undergraduate who expanded his digit span tenfold, had not increased some generalized memory capacity. Rather, he'd simply become an expert at digit memorization. When he tried to memorize lists of random consonants, he could still only remember about 7 of them. This, more than anything, is what differentiates the top memorizers from the second tier. They approach memorization like a science. They develop hypotheses about their limitations, and they conduct experiments and track data. It's like you're developing a piece of technology or working on a scientific theory. The 2-time world champ Andy Bell once told me, you have to analyze what you're doing. If I would have any chance at catapulting myself to the top tier of the competitive memorization circuit, my practice would have to be focused and deliberate. That meant I needed to collect data and analyze it for feedback. And that meant this whole operation was about to get ratcheted up. I set up a spreadsheet on my laptop to keep track of how long I was practicing and of any difficulties I was having along the way. I made graphs of everything and tracked the steady upticks in my scores in a journal. August 19th, did 28 cards in 2 minutes 57 seconds. August 20th, did 28 cards in 2 minutes 39 seconds. Solid time. August 24th, did 38 cards in 4 minutes 40 seconds. Not so good. September 8th, sitting in a Starbucks procrastinating instead of working on an overdue article. Memorized 46 digits in 5 minutes. Pathetic. Then did 48 cards in 3 minutes 32 seconds. Decided finally to change my images for the fours. Goodbye, female actresses. Hello, mental athletes. Clubs equals Ed Cook. Diamonds equals Gunter Karsten. Hearts equals Ben Pridmore. Spades equals me. October 2nd. Did 70 random words in 15 minutes. Not good. Lost points because I confused the words grow with growth and bicycle with bike. From now on, when a word has multiple close variations, make a careful mental note in Palace next to the confusing image. October 16th. Just did 87 random words. I'm doing too much eyeing of the clock and glancing around the room instead of memorizing. I'm losing time. Concentrate, man. Concentrate. Attention, of course, is a prerequisite to remembering. Generally, when we forget the name of a new acquaintance, it's because we're too busy thinking about what we're going to say next instead of paying attention. Part of the reason techniques like visual imagery and the memory palace work so well is that they enforce a degree of attention and mindfulness that is normally lacking. You can't create an image of a word, a number, or a person's name without dwelling on it, and you can't dwell on something without making it more memorable. The problem I was running into in my training was that I was simply getting bored by it and allowing my mind's eye to wander. No matter how crude, colorful, and explicit the images one paints in one's memory palaces, one can only look at pages of random numbers for so long before beginning to wonder if there isn't something more interesting going on in another room, like the sound of putting. Ed, who had taken to referring to me as son, young man, and heir four, insisted that the cure for my distractibility lay in an equipment upgrade. All serious mnemonists wear earmuffs. A few of the most serious competitors wear blinders to constrict their field of view and shut out peripheral distractions. I find them ridiculous. But in your case, they may be a sound investment, said Ed on one of our regular twice-weekly phone check-ins. That afternoon, I went out to the hardware store and bought a pair of industrial-grade earmuffs and a pair of plastic laboratory safety goggles. I spray-painted them black and then drilled a small eye hole through each lens. Henceforth, I would always wear them to practice. It was easy enough to explain to people that I was living with my parents to save a few bucks while I cut my teeth as a writer. But what I was doing in their basement, with pages of random numbers taped to the walls and old high school yearbooks, purchased at flea markets, cracked open on the floor, was, if not downright shameful, at least something to lie about. When my father would visit me in the basement to ask if I'd like to putt with him for a few minutes, I'd quickly hide the page of numbers I was memorizing and pretend to be diligently at work on something else, like an article that some publication might compensate me for with a check that might in turn be handed over to a landlord. Sometimes I'd take off my earmuffs and memory goggles and turn around to discover that my father had been standing in the doorway, just watching me. If Erickson was my professor, Ed had taken on the role of yogi and manager. He set a schedule for me for the next 4 months, with benchmarks I was supposed to meet along the way, and a strict regimen of half an hour of practice each morning, plus 2 5-minute booster sessions in the afternoon. A computer program tested me and kept detailed records of my mistakes, so that we could analyze them later. I emailed my times to Ed every few days, and he would write back with suggestions about how I could improve. Eventually, I decided I needed to go back to the mill farm to get some more face time with my coach. I scheduled my return trip to England to coincide with Ed's 25th birthday party, an epic affair that he had been talking up since I had first visited England for the World Memory Championship. Ed's party was held in the MILF's old stone barn, which Ed had spent the better part of a week converting into an experimental vessel for his philosophy of parties. I'm trying to find a framework for manipulating conversation, space, movement, mood, and expectation, so that I can see how they influence one another, he told me. In order to track all these parameters, I treat people not as volitional entities, but as automata, particles really, which bounce around the party. And as host of the party, I take seriously my responsibility of bouncing them around in the best possible manner. Glittery textiles hung from the rafters to the floor, dividing the barn into a collection of small rooms. The only way in or out was through a network of tunnels, which could be navigated only by slithering on one's belly. The space under the grand piano was turned into a fort, and a circle was formed around the fireplace out of a collection of raggedy couches that had been stacked on top of tables. The people who actually get through the tunnel networks have been through an adventure. They have had to struggle a tiny bit, and therefore upon arrival, they feel a sense of gratitude, relief, and accomplishment, and are committed to the project of having a good experience, with the most possible vigor and imagination. I think your memory training is extremely similar to this. Although it sounds silly to say, no pain, no gain, it's true. One has to hurt, to go through a period of stress, a period of self-doubt, a period of confusion. And then, out of that mess, can flow the richest tapestries. I crawled behind him through a 10-foot-long pitch-black tunnel and emerged into a room filled neck-deep with balloons. Each room, he explained, was supposed to function like a chamber of a memory palace. His party was designed to be maximally memorable. Too often, one is just left in a haze about what happened at a party because it's a single, undifferentiated space, he said. One of the advantages of this kind of setup is that the experiences in each room get kept in each room and are isolated from other experiences. One leaves the party with a beautiful repertoire of events upon which one can dwell during old and middle age. In order to facilitate social interaction, Ed felt it was critical that partygoers not be able to recognize one another. Ben Pridmore, who had taken a 4-hour train ride down from Derby, wore a black cape and a terrifying mask of a mohawked man-eater he called Grunch. Lucas Omsus, recovered from his fire-breathing fiasco, who flew in from Vienna just for the party, arrived wearing a 19th-century Austrian military uniform with a sash and medals. One of Ed's old friends from Oxford wore a full-body tiger suit. Another showed up in blackface and dreadlocks. Ed wore a curly wig, a dress, pantyhose, and a generously apportioned bra. In recognition of my being the only Yank at the party, I had my face painted like Captain America. The highlight of the evening was the card-off. Shortly before midnight, Ed gathered his 50 or so guests in the basement of the barn and announced that in honor of his quarter century of existence, two of the greatest card memorizers of all time were going to go head-to-head in competition. Ben, still wearing his black cape but no longer his grunge mask, perched on a beanbag at one end of a long table littered with empty plastic sangria cups and the skeletal remains of an entire lamb that had been spit-roasted over a backyard bonfire. Lucas sat down at the other end of the table in his Austrian military uniform. "First, I'd like to give the assembled here a few details about these two individuals' capacities to remember packs of cards," Ed announced. "Lucas was one of the first people in the world to break the 40-second barrier for a pack of cards. For a long time in the memory community, which comprises 11 people, this was regarded as the 4-minute mile. He busted that mark and busted it again, and was once upon a time the world champion in speed cards. He is also one of the founding members of a distinguished society of memorizers known as the KL7. Of course, his terrific memory would be much better if he weren't perennially drunk," Ed said hyperbolically. Lucas lifted his plastic cup and nodded it in Ed's direction. "You see, Lucas introduced me to an amusing and useful machine that he built with his engineering friends in Vienna, which allows you to drink 4 glasses of beer in less than 3 seconds. It's got a valve mechanism they had to purchase off an aerospace company. Unfortunately, Lucas has used it a bit too much recently. He hasn't memorized a deck of cards in almost a year. However, the last time he did it, he recorded a time of 35.1 seconds. Ed turned to Ben. "Pridmore here holds the current world record in cards at 31.03 seconds. And he's British." This elicited a round of rowdy cheers from the guests. "Ben has also learned 27 packs of cards in an hour, which is just, frankly, unnecessary." Ben unfolded his arms and spoke up. "Lucas and I have been talking, and we've been thinking that since Ed is ranked 17th in the world..." "You mock me," Ed protested. He didn't know that a handful of young Germans had recently passed him in the international rankings. "We've decided we will not compete unless he can tell us the name of every person in this room." There were more rowdy cheers, which Ed tried to quiet. He made it about a quarter of the way around the room before getting stumped by a friend of a friend, whom he claimed never to have met. He asked for silence, invited 2 guests to shuffle the packs of cards, and then handed them to Lucas and Ben. A stopwatch was set. They each had a minute. Barely a half dozen cards were flipped over before it became clear that Lucas, who had been keeping his head upright only with concerted vigilance, was in no condition to use his higher cognitive faculties. He laid the deck back down on the table and sheepishly announced, "At least I am still ahead of Ed in the international rankings." Ed forcefully nudged Lucas out of the way and took his seat. "On the occasion of my 25th birthday, it gives me great pleasure to say that one of the competitors in my showcase event is too drunk to compete, and I am going to have to take over." The decks were reshuffled and the stopwatch reset. "Now, Pridmore, would you calm down, please?" After a minute of hushed memorization, Ben and Ed took turns announcing cards from memory while a self-appointed judge checked to see that they were correct. "Ed, Jack of clubs. Cheers. Ben, 2 of diamonds. Booze. Ed, 9 of clubs. Cheers. Ben, 4 of spades. Booze. Ed, 5 of spades. Cheers. Ben, 8 of spades. Booze." About 40 cards into the deck, Ben shook his head and put his hands down on the table. "That's enough for me." Ed leaped up from his seat, his breast slapping his chin. "I knew Ben Pridmore would go too fast. I knew it. He crashes and burns, that guy." "How many times have you won the world championship?" Ben responded, with more bite in his voice than I'd ever heard before. Shall we clarify our record in one-on-one competition, Ben? You realize losing was my birthday present to you. As Ed circled the room, exchanging high fives and embracing his female guests, Ben slunk back into his beanbag and petted his cape. One of Ed's inebriated Oxford chums, suitably impressed with Ben's performance in spite of his loss, came up to Ben and handed him a short stack of credit cards. He told Ben that if he could memorize them, he was welcome to use them. After the card off, the party migrated outside to a bonfire that had been built in the clearing, where a drunken tribal horror lasted until the morning. When I finally went to sleep just before sunrise, Ed and Ben were still sitting around the kitchen table, reeling off the most entertainingly bizarre binary number combinations they could think of. After sleeping off our hangovers, Ed and I spent the next afternoon huddled in training around the kitchen table. I'd come to him with three particular problems I needed his help with, the most pressing of which was that I was consistently mixing up my images. When you're memorizing a deck of cards, there isn't enough time to form images with all the detail and richness that the adherennium calls for. You're moving so fast that usually you can only get the equivalent of a passing glance. In fact, more than anything else, the art of memory is learning how little of an image you need to see to make it memorable. It was only by analyzing the data I was keeping that I realized that I'd been consistently confusing the Seven of Diamonds, Lance Armstrong riding his bicycle, with the Seven of Spades, a jockey riding a racehorse. Something about the verb riding in those two very different contexts was causing me cognitive hiccups. I asked Ed what I was supposed to do about that. "Don't try to see the whole image," he said. "You don't need to. Just focus on one salient element of whatever it is you're trying to visualize. If it's your girlfriend, make sure that before all else, you see her smile. Practice studying the whiteness of her teeth, the way her lips crease. The other details will make her more memorable, but the smile will be the key. Sometimes a stab of blue that smells of oysters might be all the recall you get from some particular image. But if you know your system well, you should be able to translate that back again. Often, when you're really gunning for it, the only traces left by a speedily sighted pack of cards will be a series of emotions with no visual content whatsoever. Your other option is to change the images so they're not so similar, not so mundane." I closed my eyes and tried to visualize Lance Armstrong pedaling up a steep hill. I made a special point of focusing on the way his reflective sunglasses turned blue and green as they moved through sunlight. Then I thought about the jockey and decided he would be much more distinct as a pony-riding midget with a sombrero. That little adjustment probably shaved 2 seconds off my time. "Good stuff with the cards," Ed said when I showed my latest spreadsheet. "It's just a matter of 5 or so more hours of practice before the images are totally automatic. I've no doubt the American record in speed cards will be child's play. I weep for joy." Of course, for all the reanalysis and rejiggering that makes deliberate practice deliberate, Ed warned me that there was always a risk of overthinking things in memory sport, since every change to your mnemonic system leaves behind a trace that can come back to haunt you in competition. And if there's one thing a mental athlete wants desperately to avoid, it's for a single card or number to trigger multiple images on game day. Another problem I discovered in my practice sessions was that my card images were fading too quickly. By the time I'd get to the end of a deck or string of numbers, the images from the beginning had become faint ghosts. I mentioned this to Ed. "Well, you've got to get to know your images better," was his response. "Starting tonight, take a suit at a time and really spend meditative time with each character. Ask yourself what they look, feel, smell, taste, and sound like, how they walk, the cut of their clothes, their social attitude, their sexual preferences, their propensity to gratuitous violence. After having got this kind of feel for them, Try to let it all happen at once. Feel the full, fat force of their physical and social characteristics all at once in imaginative broadband. And then imagine them going about your house doing everyday things, so you get used to them being so rich and dense even in normal situations. That way, when they do come up in a packet of cards, they should always be offering up some salient characteristic that will stick to their surroundings. I needed Ed's help with one other problem. Following the recommendations of Peter of Ravenna and the Adherennium, my collection of PAO images included a handful of titillating acts that are still illegal in a few southern states, and a handful of others that probably ought to be. And since memorizing a deck of cards with the PAO system requires recombining pre-memorized images to create novel, memorable images, it invariably meant inserting family members into scenes so raunchy, I feared I was upgrading my memory at the expense of tormenting my subconscious. The indecent acts my own grandmother has had to commit in the service of my remembering the Eight of Hearts are truly unspeakable. If not, as I might have previously guessed, unimaginable. I explained my predicament to Ed. He knew it well. "I eventually had to excise my mother from my deck," he said. "I recommend you do the same." Ed was a stern coach who berated me for the lackadaisical character of my training. If I went more than a few days without sending him my latest times, or admitted that I was not, in fact, putting in a half hour a day as he'd commanded, I would receive a caustic reprimand via email. "You've got to step up your training, because it's inevitably the case that your performance will drop in the tournament itself," he warned. "You might have the perfect sporting mentality and actually raise your score, but you've got to work on the assumption that you're going to do better in practice than you'll do in the tournament." In my own defense, lackadaisical wasn't quite the word I'd have chosen. Now that I had put the okay plateau behind me, my scores were improving on an almost daily basis. The sheets of random numbers that I'd memorized were piling up in the drawer of my desk. The dog-eared pages of verse I'd learned by heart were accumulating in my Norton Anthology of Modern Poetry. I was beginning to suspect that if I kept improving at the current pace, I might actually have a chance of doing well in the competition. Ed sent me a quote from the venerable martial artist Bruce Lee, which he hoped would serve as inspiration. "There are no limits. There are plateaus, but you must not stay there. You must go beyond them. If it kills you, it kills you." I copied that thought onto a post-it note and stuck it on my wall. Then I tore it down and memorized it. Chapter 9. The Talented Tenth. Not long after returning from England, I found myself sitting on a folding chair in the basement of my parents' home at 6:45 a.m., wearing underpants, earmuffs, and memory goggles, with a printout of 800 random digits in my lap and an image in my mind's eye of a lingerie-clad garden gnome, 52632, suspended over my grandmother's kitchen table. I suddenly looked up, wondering, remarkably for the first time, what in the world I was doing with myself. I realized I'd become fixated on the other competitors. With the help of detailed statistics kept on the memory circuit stats server, I had made myself familiar with each of their strengths and weaknesses, and I'd measured my own scores against theirs with compulsive regularity. The opponent with whom I had become most preoccupied with was not the defending champ, Ram Coley, a 25-year-old business consultant from Richmond, Virginia, but rather Maurice Stoll, a 30-year-old beauty products importer and speed numbers hotshot from outside Fort Worth, Texas, who grew up in Germany. I had met him at the previous year's competition. He had a shaved head and a goatee, spoke with an intimidating German accent — anything Germanic is intimidating at a memory contest — and was one of the only Americans to have ever crossed the Atlantic to compete in a European memory contest. He finished 15th at the World Memory Championship in 2004 and seventh at that year's Memory World Cup. He held the U.S. records in both speed numbers, 144 digits in 5 minutes, and speed cards, a single deck in a minute and 56 seconds. His only weaknesses were poetry, in which he was ranked 99th in the world, and insomnia. Everyone agreed he ought to have won the previous year's contest, but instead stalled out and finished fourth because he'd only gotten 3 hours of rest the night before. This year, if he could get to bed on time, I expected he was the favorite to win. And I was now putting in a solid half hour a day to ensure that he didn't. As I burrowed deeper into my mental training, I was starting to wonder if the sort of memorization practiced by mental athletes was not something like a peacock's tail. Impressive not for its utility, but for its profound lack of utility. Were these ancient techniques anything more than intellectual fossils, as the historian Paolo Rossi once put it? Fascinating for what they tell us about the minds of a bygone era, but as out of place in our modern world as quill pens and papyrus scrolls? That has always been the rap against memory techniques. They're impressive, but ultimately useless. The 17th century philosopher Francis Bacon declared, "I make no more estimation of repeating a great number of names or words upon once hearing than I do the tricks of tumblers, funambulos, balladines, the one being the same in the mind that the other is in the body. Matters of strangeness without worthiness." He thought the art of memory was fundamentally barren. When the 16th century Jesuit missionary Matteo Ricci tried to introduce memory techniques to Chinese mandarins studying for the Imperial Civil Service exam, he was met with resistance. He planned to hook them first on European study skills before trying to hook them on the European God. The Chinese objected that the method of loci required so much more work than rote repetition and claimed their way of memorizing was both simpler and faster. I could understand where they were coming from. The demographics of your average memory contest are pretty much indistinguishable from those of a Weird Al Yankovic, Five of Spades, concert. An overwhelming number of contestants are young, white, male juggling aficionados, which is why it's impossible to miss the dozen or so students who show up at the U.S. Championship each year in proper church attire. They are from the Samuel Gompers Vocational High School in the South Bronx, and their American history teacher, Raymond Matthews, is a Tony Buzan disciple. If I had thought that the art of memory was just a form of mental peacocking, Matthews aimed to prove otherwise. He has dubbed the group of students he trains for the U.S. Memory Championship the Talented Tenth, after W.E.B. Du Bois's notion that an elite core of African Americans would lift the race out of poverty. When I first encountered Matthews at the 2005 U.S. Memory Championship, he was pacing anxiously at the back of the room while he waited for his students' scores in the random words event to come in. Several of his students were vying for a top 10 finish, but as far as he was concerned, the real test of their memories was still 2.5 months away, when they would sit for the New York State Regents exam. By the end of the year, he expected his students to have memorized every important fact, date, and concept in their U.S. history textbook using the same techniques they employed in the U.S. Memory Championship. He invited me to come visit his classroom to witness memory techniques being used in the real world. To take him up on his offer, I had to pass through a metal detector and have my bag searched by a police officer before entering the Gomper School building. Matthews believes that the art of memory will be his student's ticket out of a neighborhood where 9 out of 10 students are below average in reading and math, 4 out of 5 are living in poverty, and nearly half don't graduate from high school. "The memorization of quotes allows a person to seem more legitimate," he told them, while I sat in the back of his classroom. "Who are you going to be more impressed by? The person who has a litany of his own opinions, or the historian who can draw on the great thinkers who came before him?" I listened to one student recite verbatim an entire paragraph from Heart of Darkness to answer a question about 19th century global commerce. When it comes time to do the AP test, he'll pull out a quote like that, said Matthews. A dapper dresser with a goatee, closely cropped hair, and a thick Bronx accent. Every in-class essay his students write must contain at least two memorized quotations, just one of many small feats of memory that he demands from them. After school, his students come back for an extracurricular class in memorization techniques. It's the difference between only teaching a kid multiplication and giving him a calculator, Matthews says of the memory skills he imparts to them. Not surprisingly, every single member of the talented 10th has passed the Regents exam each of the last 4 years, and 85% of them have scored a 90 or better. Matthews has won 2 citywide Teacher of the Year awards. Students in the talented 10th must wear shirts and ties, and occasionally, at school assemblies, white gloves. Their classroom is plastered with posters of Marcus Garvey and Malcolm X. When they graduate, they receive a kente cloth with the words Talented 10th embossed in gold. At the beginning of each class, the Talented 10th stand behind their desks, arranged in a pair of facing aisles, and recite in unison a 3-minute manifesto from memory that begins, "We are the very best our community has to offer. We will not get lower than 95% on any history exam. We are the vanguard of our people. Either walk with our glory and rise to the top with us, or step aside. For when we get to the top, we will reach back and raise you up with us." The 43 kids in Matthew's class are all honors students who had to pass a high bar just to get selected for the talented 10th. And Matthews works his students hard. "We don't get no vacations," one of them complained to me, while Matthews was standing close enough to overhear. "You work now so you can rest later," he told the student. "You carry your books now so someone else can carry your books later." The success of Matthews' students raises questions about the purposes of education that are as old as schooling itself and never seem to go away. What does it mean to be intelligent? And what exactly is it that schools are supposed to be teaching? As the role of memory in the conventional sense has diminished, what should its place be in contemporary pedagogy? Why bother loading up kids' memories with facts unless you're ultimately preparing them for a world of externalized memories? In my own elementary and secondary education, at both public and private schools, I can recall being made to memorize exactly 3 texts: the Gettysburg Address in 3rd grade, Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech in 4th grade, and Macbeth's Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow soliloquy in 10th. That's it. The only activity more antithetical than memorization to the ideals of modern education is corporal punishment. The slow disappearance of classroom memorization had its philosophical roots in Jean-Jacques Rousseau's polemical 1762 novel, Emile, or On Education, in which the Swiss philosopher imagined a fictional child raised by means of a natural education, learning only through self-experience. Rousseau abhorred memorization, as well as just about every other stricture of institutional education. "Reading is the great plague of childhood," he wrote. The traditional curriculum, he believed, was little more than fatuous heraldry, geography, chronology, and language. The educational ideology that Rousseau rebelled against truly was mind-numbing and much in need of correction. More than 100 years after Emile's publication, when the muckraker Dr. Joseph Mayer Rice toured public schools in 36 cities, he came away appalled at what he saw, calling one New York City school the most dehumanizing institution that I have ever laid eyes upon, each child being treated as if he possessed a memory and the faculty of speech, but no individuality, no sensibilities, no soul. At the turn of the 20th century, rote memorization was still the preferred way to put information, especially history and geography, into kids' heads. Students could be expected to memorize poetry, great speeches, historical dates, times tables, Latin vocabulary, state capitals, the order of American presidents, and much else. Memorization drills weren't just about transferring information from teacher to student. They were actually thought to have a constructive effect on kids' brains that would benefit them throughout their lives. Rote drills, it was thought, built up the faculty of memory. The what that was memorized mattered, but so too did the mere fact that the memory was being exercised. The same was thought to be true of Latin, which at the turn of the 20th century was taught to nearly half of all American high school students. Educators were convinced that learning the extinct language, with its countless grammatical niceties and difficult conjugations, trained the brain in logical thinking and helped build mental discipline. Tedium was actually seen as a virtue, and the teachers were backed up by a popular scientific theory known as faculty psychology, which held that the mind consisted of a handful of specific mental faculties that could each individually be trained, like muscles, through rigorous exercise. Toward the end of the 19th century, a group of leading psychologists began to question the empirical basis of faculty psychology. In his 1890 book, Principles of Psychology, William James set out to see whether a certain amount of daily training in learning poetry by heart will shorten the time it takes to learn an entirely different kind of poetry. He spent more than 2 hours over 8 successive days memorizing the first 158 lines of the Victor Hugo poem, Satyr, averaging 50 lines a second. With that baseline established, James set about memorizing the entire first book of Paradise Lost. When he returned to Hugo, he found that his memorization time had actually declined to 57 seconds a line. Practicing memorization had made him worse at it, not better. It was just a single data point, but subsequent studies by the psychologist Edward Thorndike and his colleague Robert S. Woodworth also questioned whether the general ability to memorize was influenced by practice memorizing, and found only minor gains. They concluded that the ancillary benefits of mental discipline were mythological, and that general skills, like memorization, were not nearly as transferable as had once been thought. Pedagogues quickly realized that Thorndike's experiments had undermined the rationale for the traditional curriculum, writes the historian of education Diane Ravitch. Into this void rushed a group of progressive educators led by the American philosopher John Dewey, who began making the case for a new kind of education that would radically break with the constricted curriculum and methods of the past. They echoed Rousseau's romantic ideals of childhood and put a new emphasis on child-centered education. They did away with rote memorization and replaced it with a new kind of experiential learning. Students would study biology not by memorizing plant anatomy from a textbook, but by planting seeds and tending gardens. They'd learn arithmetic not through times tables, but through baking recipes. Dewey declared, "I would have a child say not, 'I know,' but 'I have experienced.'" The last century has been an especially bad one for memory. 100 years of progressive education reform have discredited memorization as oppressive and stultifying, not only a waste of time, but positively harmful to the developing brain. Schools have de-emphasized raw knowledge, most of which gets forgotten anyway, and instead stressed their role in fostering reasoning ability, creativity, and independent thinking. But is it possible we've been making a huge mistake? The influential critic E.D. Hirsch Jr. complained in 1987, "We cannot assume that young people today know things that were known in the past by almost every literate person in the culture." Hirsch has argued that students are being sent out into the world without the basic level of cultural literacy that is necessary to be a good citizen. What does it say that 2/3 of American 17-year-olds can't even tell you within 50 years when the Civil War occurred? And what's needed is a kind of educational counter-reformation that re-emphasizes hard facts. Hirsch's critics have pointed out that the curriculum he advocates is dead white males 101. But if anyone seems qualified to counter that argument, it is Matthews, who maintains that for all the Eurocentrism of the curriculum, the fact is that facts still matter. If one of the goals of education is to create inquisitive, knowledgeable people, then you need to give students the most basic signposts that can guide them through a life of learning. And if, as the 12th century teacher Hugo of St. Victor put it, the whole usefulness of education consists only in the memory of it, then you might as well give them the best tools available to commit their education to memory. I don't use the word memory in my class, because it's a bad word in education, says Matthews. You make monkeys memorize, whereas education is the ability to retrieve information at will and analyze it. But you can't have higher level learning. You can't analyze without retrieving information. And you can't retrieve information without putting the information in there in the first place. The dichotomy between learning and memorizing is false, Matthews contends. You can't learn without memorizing. And if done right, you can't memorize without learning. Memory needs to be taught as a skill, in exactly the same way that flexibility and strength and stamina are taught to build up a person's physical health and well-being, argues Buzan, who often sounds like an advocate of the old faculty psychology. Students need to learn how to learn. First, you teach them how to learn, then you teach them what to learn. The formal education system came out of the military, where the least educated and most educationally deprived people were sent into the army, he says. In order for them not to think, which is what you wanted them to do, they had to obey orders. Military training was extremely regimented and linear. You pounded the information into their brains and made them respond in a Pavlovian manner, without thinking. Did it work? Yes. Did they enjoy the experience? No, they didn't. When the Industrial Revolution came, soldiers were needed on the machines, and so the military approach to education was transferred into school. It worked, but it doesn't work over the long term. Like many of Buzan's pontifications, this one conceals a kernel of truth beneath an overlay of propaganda. Rote learning, the old drill-and-kill method that education reformers have spent the last century rebelling against, is surely as old as learning itself. But Buzan is right that the art of memory, once at the center of a classical education, had all but disappeared in the 19th century. Buzan's argument that schools have been teaching memory in entirely the wrong way deeply challenges reigning ideas in education and is often couched in the language of revolution. In fact, though Buzan doesn't seem to see it this way, his ideas are not revolutionary so much as deeply conservative. His goal is to turn the clock back to a time when a good memory still counted for something. Pinning down Tony Buzan for an interview is no easy task. He is on the road lecturing roughly 9 months of the year and boasts of having racked up enough frequent flyer miles to go to the moon and back 8 times. What's more, he seems to cultivate the sense of aloofness and inaccessibility that are prerequisite for any self-respecting guru. When I finally corralled him behind a desk at the World Memory Championship to discuss the possibility of our sitting down for a couple hours, he opened a large 3-ring binder and unfurled a colorful panoramic chart, perhaps 3 feet long. It was his calendar from the previous year, and it was filled with expansive, continuous blocks of travel: Spain, China, Mexico 3 times, Australia, America. There was 1 3-month period when he didn't set foot in the United Kingdom. He told me that he absolutely didn't have any time to speak with me for at least 3 or 4 weeks, by which time I would be back home in the United States. But he suggested I visit his estate halfway to Oxford on the River Thames and take some photographs while he was away. I told him I didn't see how I was likely to learn very much from an empty house. "Oh, you'd learn quite a lot," he said. Eventually, through his assistant, I was able to fix an hour with Bouzon in his limousine on his way home from the BBC studios in London, where he had just wrapped up a TV interview. I was told to go to a street corner in Whitehall and wait. You won't be able to miss Mr. Bouzon's car. There was, in fact, no missing it. The car, which pulled up about half an hour late, was a bright ivory 1930s taxicab that looked like it might have just been driven off a BBC set. The door flew open. "Step inside," said Bouzon, beckoning. "Welcome to my small, traveling, beautiful lounge." The first subject we spoke about, because I had to ask, was his unique wardrobe. "I designed it myself," he told me. He was wearing the same unusual dark navy suit with the large gold buttons that I'd seen him in at the U.S. Championship months earlier. "I used to lecture in an off-the-peg suit, but I was tugging at it with my expansive gestures," he told me. "So I studied 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th, and 19th century sword fighters and how their arms had not one iota of resistance from their wardrobes. Those ruffles and big sleeves weren't just for show. They were for thrusting and parrying. I designed my shirt so that I, too, am free to move." Everything about Bouzon gives the strong impression of someone wanting to make a strong impression. He never swallows a syllable or slouches. His fingernails are as well cared for as the leather of his Italian shoes. There is always a pocket handkerchief tucked neatly in his breast pocket. He signs his letters Florient Dendrite, "May your brain cells flourish," and ends his phone messages, "Tony Bouzon, over and out." When I asked him about the source of his incredible self-confidence, he told me that he owes much of it to his extensive training in the martial arts. He has a black belt in Aikido and is three-quarters of his way to a black belt in karate. Sitting in the back seat of his limo, he demonstrated a series of jerky moves, a slice through the air, and a shadow punch. "The way I use these techniques is not by using them," he said. "What's the point of fighting if you know you can kill the other, i.e. human, or you can take out his eye or rip out his tongue?" Bouzon is, he often found occasion to remind me, a modern Renaissance man, a student of dance, ballroom, modern, jazz, a composer, influences, Philip Glass, Beethoven, Elgar, an author of short stories about animals, under the nom de plume Mowgli, after the Boy in the Jungle book, a poet. His last collection, Concordia, consists entirely of poems written on and about his 38 transatlantic flights aboard the supersonic Concorde. And a designer, not just of his wardrobe, but also of his home and much of the furniture in it. About 45 minutes outside of London, our ivory chariot pulled into Bouzon's estate on the River Thames. He asked that I not name its location in print. "Just call it Wind in the Willows territory." Inside his home, named the Gates of Dawn, we took off our shoes and tiptoed around a collection of drawings that had been laid out across the floor, part of an illustrated children's book that he was working on, about a little boy who doesn't do well in school but does very well in his imagination. There was a large television set with at least 100 VHS tapes scattered about it, and a bookshelf in the foyer that held the complete Encyclopedia Britannica Great Books of the Western World, several copies of the sci-fi thriller Dune, three copies of the Koran, a large quantity of books authored by Bouzon, and not much else. "Is this your library?" I asked. "I'm only here 3 months of the year. I have libraries in several other places around the world," he said. Bouzon revels in travel and in being a man of the world. Once, when I asked him where he's able to find the concentration to turn out 2 or 3 books a year, he told me that he has found serene spots to work on almost every continent. "In Australia, at the Great Barrier Reef, I write. In Europe, wherever there are oceans, I write. In Mexico, I write. At the Great West Lake in China, I write." Bouzon has been traveling since he was a young boy. He was born in London in 1942, but moved with his brother and parents. His mother was a legal stenographer, his father an electrical engineer, to Vancouver at age 11. He was, he says, basically a normal kid, in normal trouble, in normal schools. My best friend growing up was a boy named Barry, Bouzon recalled, sitting outside on his patio with a pink shirt unbuttoned and a pair of large, wraparound geriatric sunglasses protecting his eyes. He was always in the 1D classes, while I in 1A. 1A was for the bright kids, D for the dunces. But when we went out into nature, Barry could identify things by the way they flew over the horizon. Just from their flight patterns, he could distinguish between a red admiral, a painted thrush, and a blackbird, which are all very similar. So I knew he was a genius. And I got a top mark in an exam on nature, a perfect mark, answering questions like, name two fish you can find living in an English stream. There are 103. But when I got back my perfect mark on the test, I suddenly realized that the kid sitting down the hall in the dunces class, my best friend, Barry, knew more than I knew, much more than I knew, in the subject in which I was supposedly number one. And therefore, he was number one, and I was not number one. And suddenly, I realized the system that I was in did not know what intelligence was, didn't know how to identify smart and not smart. They called me the best, when I knew I wasn't, and they called him the worst, when he was the best. I mean, there could be no more antipodal environment. So I began to question, what is intelligence? Who says? Who says you're smart? Who says you're not smart? And what do they mean by that? Those questions, at least according to Bouzon's tidy personal narrative, dogged him until he got to college. Bouzon's introduction to the art of memory, the moment that set his entire life on its present path, came, he explained, in the first minutes of his first class on the first day of his first year at the University of British Columbia. His English professor, a dour man built like a very short wrestler with red tufts of hair on his otherwise bald head, walked into the class and proceeded, with his hands behind his back, to call out the roll of students perfectly. Whenever someone was absent, he told off their name, their father's name, their mother's name, their date of birth, phone number, and address, recalls Bouzon. And as soon as he'd done it, he looked at us with a sneer on his face. That was the beginning of my love affair with memory. After class, Bouzon charged down the hall after his professor. I said, "Professor, how did you do that?" He turned to me and he said, "Son, I'm a genius." So I said, "Sir, that is obvious, but I still want to know how you did it." He simply said, "No." Every day we had English for the next 3 months, I tested him. I felt he had the Holy Grail, and he wouldn't share it. He despised his students. He thought they were a waste of time. Then one day he said, "In the beginning of this miserable relationship between myself and yourselves, I demonstrated the exquisite power of human memory, and none of you even noticed. So I'm now going to put on the board the code by which I managed to accomplish that extraordinary feat, and I am utterly convinced that none of you will even recognize the treasures put before you. These pearls before swine." He winked at me and he put up the code. It was the major system. Suddenly, I realized I could memorize anything. Bouzon left class that day in a trance. It occurred to him, for the first time, that he had not even the most basic idea about how the complicated machinery of his mind worked. And that seemed odd. If the simplest memory trick could dramatically increase the amount of information a person could remember, and nobody had bothered to teach him that trick until he was 20 years old, what else was there that he'd never learned? I went to the library and I said, "I want a book on how to use my brain." The library sent me to the medical section, and I came back and said, I don't want a book on how to operate on my brain. I want a book on how to operate it. Slightly different. She said, Oh, there are no books on that. I thought, You get an operations manual on your car, your radio, your TV, but no operations manual on the human brain.